This is a download from Newstalk 106 to 108. To download other programmes or for more information, go to newstalk.ie.
The separation between science and human values is an illusion.
Where did we come from?
This is the first self-replicating species on the planet.
Future Proof. In partnership with Science Foundation Ireland. Research for Ireland's future.
Hello and good evening. Welcome to your weekly dose of science, Future Proof, on Newstalk 106 to 108 FM. I'm Jonathan McRae. As always, you can email us at science@newstalk.ie or follow us on Twitter at Newstalk Science. On this week's show, we speak to the world's first cyborg, Professor Kevin Warwick. Neve Shaw tries to boost her creativity, and we look at why we see in colour with Mark Changizi. But first, in studio is Ian Brunswick from the Science Gallery. Hi, Ian. How are you?
Hey, Jonathan. Doing good.
You're bringing the week stories to us, as always. And we're going to start off with the interesting one about birds having bigger brains if they live in the city.
Yeah, the kinds of birds that live in cities, this new study has shown, tend to have bigger brains. It's in Biology Letters. And what they looked at is they surveyed lots of birds, mostly on continental European cities, and looked at the size of the brain of the birds who live in the city, like the hustle and bustle, versus the birds that are outside of the city generally. And they're not saying, you know, the conclusion from this is that birds in the cities have bigger brains. They're not saying if a bird flies into the city, its brain grows, or you know, in a couple generations, it has to develop a bigger brain. But what they're basically saying is birds with bigger brains are probably better at adapting, and moving to the city takes some adaptation. So birds with bigger brains are naturally suited to it. Now, there are some smaller brain birds who you see around cities, but what they basically say, their hypothesis is that these birds have habitats in the natural world that are very similar to the city. So it actually didn't take much effort. So what they're saying is crows, for example, are one of the biggest brain birds, and they're probably the smartest bird, actually, of all. They love cities. They do great in cities, and they thrive in cities. And things like pigeons, it's kind of hard to believe, actually have big brains. From what I've seen pigeons doing, I find that extremely hard to believe. But these birds that like cities have big brains because they can adapt this new environment and how humans live.
Yeah, we know that birds can change their habits and their behavior because of urban environments. I think there's a bird I was reading up on this called the scrub jay, where they might start breeding 3 weeks earlier than normal, or they might actually become nocturnal when they weren't previously nocturnal, to kind of adapt to the city's living patterns and how people interact with the birds. So it's obviously safer for them to do their work at night, so they've become more nocturnal.
Yeah, there's weird things. Well, I shouldn't say weird, but there's innovative adaptations that birds do in the cities, like where there are lots of noise from cars, birds will start singing their songs a little bit earlier. So it might be dark, the dawn hasn't come yet, but they'll be singing extra early. And I know they've woken me up late, you know, late at night or early in the morning singing, because if they sing during the day when there's too much traffic from that rush hour, nobody else will hear them. So they do that kind of thing. And also birds will sometimes be shown to migrate maybe a little differently if you feed them lots, because they don't really have to go out and hunt their food. They get the food sooner, so they can migrate sooner. So birds are changing and have been changing their behavior, appetites, everything, because they're around humans.
So I don't suppose we can extrapolate from this that people who live in cities are smarter than people who live in the country.
Maybe we're adaptable, but I can't say we have bigger brains, no.
Our next story is China rocketing into space in breakneck speed.
Yeah, when you take into account how long the U.S. and Russia, formerly the USSR, had been going at their space programs and where they've gotten to now, it's incredible how quickly China have gotten into space and what they're doing. China put their first astronaut in orbit in 2003 and only 5 years later had their first spacewalk. I mean, that's incredible. When you look at, this is the 50th anniversary of Yuri Gagarin and, you know, being in space. Now, it took a long time to get somebody to do a spacewalk after that. But China are really moving along, and they've now announced that they're going to make a space station. So we currently have the ISS, the International Space Station, but that's even a temporary thing. That's going to 2020. Maybe they'll extend it a little bit. But things like the ISS, the US space program, the Russian space program, and the European space program, these are all kind of not really thriving and having a lot of money at the moment. They're kind of saying, how can we do a little cheaper, a little quicker, a little more, you know, a little smaller? The plans to go back to the moon, the plans to go to Mars, those are all getting scaled back a little bit. And China, with this new thing called Tiangong, is just plowing ahead, you know, full speed ahead, and they're planning on going to the moon then. So Things are going good.
Is this a national pride thing? Because, as you say, it's not turning out to be an extremely profitable business going into space. In fact, it costs a huge amount of money. And while there are advancements made along the way in technology that may help us here on Earth, it costs so much money. And so the shuttle program is gone. The European Space Agency, they're looking at contractors to get stuff up there because they can't afford to fund all this themselves. And China have just gone, do you know what? We're going to build a space station entirely on our own. It sounds like, you know, the time Vladimir Putin put on his military display, that, you know, that this is sort of a fluffing of the peacock's feathers.
Yeah, rattling the saber. Like, maybe not. I mean, on the one hand, they're saying we're going to go it alone and we're going to do a big thing. Now, it's smaller than the ISS, it's smaller than Mir, but it's still a humongous undertaking. On the other hand, there's a nice sort of thing they've thrown out. It can have the same docking hardware so that it could meet up with the ISS potentially, and it could use the same thing. So if the ISS wants to get rid of something, they could use it over there. So that's kind of a little bit of an olive branch there, but of course it's going to be a huge element of national pride. And on the other hand, some people who really want more space program from Europe and the US, they'll say maybe this will spark, you know, even a kind of a peaceful space race, you know, a little bit of friendly competition to get a rejuvenation into the current space programs.
Do we know what they're going to be doing up there? I mean, there's always these conspiracy theories that the superpowers are trying to weaponize space. Well, what are the Chinese? I'm not saying that's going to happen. That's actually terribly.
No, I mean, like,
but what are they doing up there?
I mean, if it's in any nation's advantage to be you know, doing military research and military exercise in space, I think we'd be naive to say, oh no, they wouldn't be doing that. I mean, they probably are. Like, there's many launches up into space and orbit that we don't really know the purpose of, and they could very well be for military things. But I'm sure it's for research. I'm sure it's for as many things are at the ISS. Public communication. I mean, promotion of science, promotion of research. That's really becoming a bigger and bigger central role of the ESA and NASA, and that's something they really pride on. So I'm sure China will want to publicize its achievements, its research, and potentially its collaboration with the ISS in the future. So maybe there's probably both elements here.
Which is quite interesting, because I think, I don't know whether it was Japan or China, I was reading today that they're struggling with the number of PhDs that they're pumping out, that there's a real problem with the PhD system at the moment, and there was this drive to get people involved in science, and now they've got so many doctors, they don't know what to do with them all. They you know, they can't find work domestically, and they're difficult to export. So yeah. It's funny, you know, they, one nation is crying out for them, and another nation is producing far too many. So it'll be interesting to see what the net effect of this promotion of the space program will be.
Yeah, I'm sure they'll, you know, it'll be very popular there, and they sound like they have a lot of impetus for it and a lot of public support, so they're going at it very quickly.
Our final story is quite interesting because it brings two things together that they never really existed in my brain: leprosy and armadillos. I when I read this, I thought someone's pulling my leg. What exactly is going on here?
That was bad. Someone's pulling my leg,
and it fell off.
yeah, armadillos, leprosy, both independently fascinating and quite curious things themselves. But a new study has basically found a whole new strain of leprosy that only exists in humans and armadillos. And if that wasn't, I guess, bad enough, it can be transferred from, well, they're pretty sure it can be transferred from armadillos to people. But basically what's happened is, in the past couple of years, more and more people in the southern U.S., the southern United States, are getting leprosy. And this is an extremely rare condition. It's treatable. It is a chronic condition. But we're talking in a country of more than 300 million, less than 4,000 people in the entire U.S. are under treatment for it. And we're talking probably under 200 new cases a year. And most of those are for people who travel abroad and they come into contact with another human who has it. But basically what they're finding in Mississippi, for example, is people who said, I've been in close contact with armadillos. I don't know how common that is. but apparently there's a niche of people who say, oh yes, I have been in close contact with armadillos frequently, are coming in with bumps or rashes, and they're getting tested, and it turns out to be this new kind of leprosy.
It's like an episode of House where, you know, they do a differential diagnostic, and they go, right, okay, so this person's coming with leprosy. There isn't any leprosy in the area. What are they coming in contact with? And you know, going through the list, they found that the common element here is having touched or been near an armadillo. It sounds like some sort of a joke. But it is curable, though. Leprosy is curable.
Yeah. I mean, people are treated for it, and it's a manageable condition. I mean, it's not... it's not this common conception in the olden days that you're sent off to an island or something. That's not the way this is treated. So there is there's a lot of misconception about leprosy, but that's primarily because it's so rare in modern developed countries.
Why armadillos?
That's even weirder, is because it's only armadillos. Armadillos and humans are the only two things I know of that can get this bacteria that causes leprosy. And armadillos, it seems to be a fluke in their genetic code that they're happy for it. Their body isn't even that much like it. One thing that looks like it might help is they have a very low body temperature. Their body temperature is around 90 degrees Fahrenheit, whereas humans are about 98.6, which is even seems even stranger to
roughly
me.
Roughly
98.6, occasionally a bit more. But it seems even weirder to me. Why would one bacteria like two animals who have very different temperatures and nothing in between?
And so, they couldn't really be more different as species. I mean, if you look at an armadillo and its makeup, it's very difficult to see where the crossover in genes is.
Yeah, it seems like you'd pick a lot of animals who are closer to humans before you'd get down to armadillos.
Well, very interesting stuff. There is a brilliant exhibition going on at the Science Gallery at the moment, Human Plus. That's been going on for the past week and a bit now, and it's going on till what?
It's going on to June 24th.
June 24th.
So it's one of our longer exhibitions. It's good. We've had a lot of people, all age groups, coming in to see it. There's some really cool, challenging stuff. We've got great events. We've got Magic Kumar on May 10th, who's the author of Quantum. We've got James Boyle, a former director of Creative Commons, on May 12th. That's going to be really cool. One's in association with SFI, and one's with McCann Fitzgerald. And we even had Kevin Warwick. So we have lots of great speakers coming in.
Great stuff, Ian. Thanks very much for coming in.
Thanks, Jonathan.
Ian Brunswick there from the Science Gallery. If you want to know more about any of the stories we discussed, you can find links to them up on our website, newstalk.ie/futureproof. And Ian mentioned Kevin Warwick there. I had an exclusive interview with him last week, which we'll be playing just after this. This is a controversial figure in science. He's the first person to ever interface a computer with a human nervous system, and that's earned him the label Captain Cyborg. That's in a few minutes' time, right here on Future Proof. That's right, you're listening to Future Proof on News Talk 106 to 108 FM. I'm Jonathan McRae. Very excited about this next interview. I managed to get an exclusive face-to-face with a man that's intrigued me for years. He's got the nickname Captain Cyborg for his controversial work in which he put implants into his own body. It's Professor Kevin Warwick. I'm sitting across one of the most controversial men in science today, I think. I think that's a fair assessment. It's Professor Kevin Warwick. He's the first person to ever interface his body with a computer and has earned himself the nickname Captain Cyborg as a result. You're very welcome to the program, Kevin.
Thank you. It's great. Great to be here. Yeah.
Would you consider yourself a controversial figure?
Well, it seems to be. I mean, I'm trying to look partly at using implants to help people with problems, people maybe paralyzed or so on. Can we get them moving around or controlling technology? But also looking at the human enhancement issues. But having implants myself, which is what happened, and some of my students have implants. So it does raise a bit of controversy. I guess some scientists maybe don't like the idea for some reason. I can't imagine why.
Let's talk a little bit about how you were in this controversy then. Talk to us about the implants that you have put inside your body. Yeah.
First of all, I mean, doctors. I'm working with doctors. The first one was back in 98, so a fair time ago. That was what's called a radio frequency identification device, RFID, which now a lot of animals, if anybody knows a cat or a dog, have a smaller version of what I had. But what it did for me, and this was always the first human to have one of these, for what it's worth, it identified me to the computer in my building. And so as I walked around, the computer knew it was me, so it opened doors for me, switched on lights, said hello, all sorts of things. Partly what we were trying to show is what's the possibility with intelligent buildings, buildings that know who you are in the building, so they do things for you. So it's trying to show the technology there. But also, when you have it implanted, this identification thing, sort of philosophically how it means, that it's you're being identified part of the system, sort of linked into the matrix, as it were.
That was the first implant that you had. And I think now, looking back, I suppose it's fairly basic, particularly compared to your second implant, which was a lot more dangerous and a lot more involved.
As the expression goes, it's a whole different bowl of wax, I think. No, it's a very different thing. That was 100 electrodes. This is very, very small spikes, very much like an electric plug that you push in a socket, which has two or three pins. This thing had 100 pins, and it was fired into the nervous system in my left arm, literally hammered in. And we linked my nervous system to the computer. And back the other way, we could send signals, electrical signals, from the computer into my nervous system. Now, of course, how the brain works and the nervous system is by electrochemical signals, partly chemical, but it's very much electrical. And we were picking up on those signals in my nervous system. So when I closed my hand, that we could clear brain signals on my nervous system that we could send via the computer out to pieces of technology. So my brain signals were able to control a robot hand, to switch on lights, even drove a wheelchair around. So partly trying to show if somebody was paralyzed and had this same implant in their brain, they could control a wheelchair, drive themselves around, could drive themselves around in a car, drive their own car, as it were, just by thinking about it. They wouldn't need to actually steer the wheel and move things with their hands if they wouldn't be able to if they're paralyzed. But just by thinking about it, they can drive themselves around. So partly we're trying to show, hey, we have the technology to do that now.
And we saw this in a headline not so long ago about a woman who has locked-in syndrome, and she is able to use this sort of a device to actually move a robotic hand, which is very close to beginning a race of cyborgs. And this is something that you're very excited about.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, first of all, it is very exciting for what we can do with people, all sorts of neurological problems. People who are paralyzed, people who have Parkinson's disease, people who have epilepsy. With the technology now, it's completely changing life for those sort of people, opening up a whole new way of life. But for everybody, it offers the possibility of enhancement, giving ourselves particularly mental abilities that as humans we don't have. I mean, let's face it, the human brain has a number of brain cells. It can do some things okay, but there's a lot of things it can't do. Well, that's going to change. With technology linked in, so your brain is linked directly to a computer, then the range of abilities that you have increases dramatically. One example, which I experienced, was extrasensory input, extending the range of senses that we have. I had an ultrasonic sense, a bit like a bat senses the world, so I was able to detect distance to objects very accurately, and if there were small changes, I could detect that. So with a blindfold on for the experiment, I could move around, I didn't bump into things because I could detect them ultrasonically. And the important thing was
like echolocation, like bats.
That's exactly that. But for me, it didn't feel like somebody was touching me. It didn't feel painful. This was an extra sense. It was a bat-like sense, as it were. And clearly, in the future, we've got now students experimenting with infrared via a different route, which is like the remote detection of heat. You know, you can literally detect somebody behind a wall because of their body heat, things like that, which at the moment, obviously, we can't do.
These are superpowers that you're talking of. These are previously things that we thought were reserved for the pages of Marvel Comics.
Yes.
Is there a danger here with the amount of modification that happens? If, as you say, we all start to develop echolocation in our fingers, or we can sense infrared, is there a possibility that we'll be creating a new race entirely? Not just humans, but superhumans. And if so, what are the implications of that?
No, well, you're quite right. I think with technology, to be honest, with computers, cell phones, it stretches society. The poor people in underdeveloped countries can't afford the technology, don't have any of it. Those that do, it does give them you know, much more abilities to communicate and so on, things that are important as far as the brain's concerned. But I think when we look at implants which directly affect your intelligence, I mean, quite simply that you're able to communicate, to sense, to think in more dimensions and so on, it enhances you intellectually. I think it not only stretches society, but there will be a point where, a bit like an elastic band, you pull it so far, it breaks, and we end up with two pieces. One of them is humans, as we know now, but with little or no technology, and the other is the enhanced, those that have the technology implanted in them, linked into a machine network with abilities way beyond what the humans have. One key thing there, that when you're linked, if your brain is linked into the network, my brain is linked into the network, we don't have to communicate anymore by this old-fashioned technique called speech. We'll be able to think to each other emotionally, concepts, ideas, colors, whole new exciting way of communication, way beyond how we communicate as humans.
Wow, this is sort of X-Men stuff. It kind of reminds me of...
this is for real. I mean, this is science we're talking of now. So this is actually doing it. And we've already gone. Already with my wife, Irena, we had electrodes. I had my electrodes in my nervous system. She had electrodes in her nervous system. We sent signals from nervous system to nervous system. So if somebody's thinking, oh, he's just speculating. Well, a little bit. But on a scientific basis, that we have already communicated directly nervous system to nervous system, this is just saying, what's the next step? Brain to brain. So clearly that is quite possible, but we don't know how well it's going to work and how rich the information passing will be until we do the experiments.
Following from this sort of logic, we may actually be able to pass on our senses of things to other people. So if we can connect brain to brain, blind people might be able to see through our senses, theoretically. We might be able to pass on the taste of chocolate to someone who hasn't actually eaten the chocolate. I mean,
so
are these things...
Are these things completely out of the realm of possibility? I think it's good to have an open mind rather than a closed mind with this. I mean, frankly, we don't know until we go there and try it. So what you're speculating, different hypotheses that might be possible, yeah, they might be possible. The only way we'll find out is to try it and see, have implants, send signals. A blind person has implants and maybe send signals from my brain to their brain. Possibly it could give them information via a different route, because this wouldn't be directly replacing their eyes. It would be bringing in sensory information via a different brain.
What I love about you, Kevin, is that you're not a theoretical person.
I have to say, I do the equation. I do the. I have to produce the academic papers, so that's all there. I mean, I produce more than...
But what I mean is, you don't just say it, you actually go ahead and do it. One of the quotes I saw you say in a video is, let's just go and try it.
Oh, yeah.
Some people don't want you to do that.
I think the only main critics I get are from some more fuddy-duddy academics. You know, that's the main thing. Oh, this isn't the sort of thing that we should be doing, that sort of thing. Probably because they're a bit jealous they're not doing it themselves, I have to say. And maybe they're a bit too old and past it. So I think the younger generation, to be honest, last night, talking here in Dublin, fantastic audience. And I think there are many people up for it. There were quite a few people volunteering, wanting to join me. So I think there's a whole different mindset, people that have been brought up with computers all around, what the possibilities are.
Would it bother you to find out that your infrared finger or your ultrasonic finger is being used in a war field to make someone a better killer?
Again, the defense thing, it's a difficult one, because, you know, if it's our team, if it's the home team, then you're helping your country, you're helping defend your nation or the status, how you are. However, I'm not really one who goes out directly to develop weapons of any... I could not have been part of Oppenheimer's development of the atom bomb in the second, even though it was for defense of the Western world. I don't know that I could have gone for something that was specifically aimed at developing a weapon system. However, as a scientist, I think you know, any scientist who is honest will know that what they're doing could be used for good, as we define it, could be used for bad. Whether military use is bad is, of course, another argument. But I think you live with that as a scientist. Okay, you can try and forget about it and say, oh, well, it's not really going to be used for bad. What I'm doing is for good. But I mean, part of what I'm doing is developing technology that will help people who are paralyzed, who have Parkinson's disease, who have epilepsy, who possibly have Alzheimer's disease, all sorts of possibilities there, which we'd say is great. That's good. It's helping lots of people. At the same time, exactly the same technology could be used in the defense sector, could open up possibilities of people hacking into your brain and changing what you're thinking before you even know what you're thinking. So it opens up all sorts of potential negatives. Yes, but should we stop? Because and so people who are paralyzed have to stay paralyzed because we're not doing the tech? No, I think we push forward scientifically and hope that it gets used for more positive things rather than negative.
You have to get all of your work passed by an ethics board. What is it like putting forward one of these papers, say, for example, back in 1998 or 2002, saying, this is what I want to do? How do people react?
Well, we do it the formal way. I mean, even now, I have students who want implants, they want to experience. And what we're doing is putting magnets in their fingers. This is as part of their course. We have to get ethical approval for that. It is tedious, I have to say, filling in the forms. I'm not a form-filling person. I'm an experimental scientist. That's what I like to do. But we have to do it, and I accept that we have to do it. It can be difficult at times. I mean, for that, the implants that the students are getting, it is a tattoo artist called Dr. Evil. That's his name, his trade name. He puts these implants in place, which is very difficult when the more upper crusts of the academic world look at the ethical application and it says, yes, these implants, this is for serious study. Implants are going to be put in by Dr. Evil. Naturally, they raise their eyebrows somewhat. And we perhaps make our life a little bit more difficult for ourselves than we... But we fight the case and it's okay. They realize that he is actually an okay guy and the methods that he uses and the procedures are all right. And that's his trade name, as it were. So it's a necessary thing to go through. I respect that it's an appropriate thing for us to do. And I wouldn't want to do anything without it. I have at times when ethically something has been seen to be not appropriate, so I have pulled back from it. And I think that's right. It's good that there are checks by society on what we're doing. But it does mean everything that I've done, the implants in myself, with student implants, I work with Parkinson's disease, I've said, everything that I've done has ethical approval. It's been given the okay.
Finally, what are you looking at in the future?
I tell you on this. I mean, one thing that we're doing at the moment, we're taking brain cells, firstly from rat embryos, and growing them and putting them in a robot body. So some of the robots now have a biological brain. We also have human brain cells that we actually buy and we grow them, and we have robots with human brains, if you like. Now we're looking at how they learn and how they memorize things and how they adapt, which is exciting, but of course it has ethical approval, which some people may say, you can't put human brains in a robot body, but it's considered there's possibilities to learn all sorts of things about how human brains
are. Human brains or are they brain cells?
This is a good question. I mean, they are human brain cells to start with, but we feed them and they grow, so in a way, they are a different type of human brain, and it's more of a philosophical question. When we grow them bigger and better, as it were, then in terms of numbers, I can see that, not this year, but maybe next year or the year after, we could potentially grow a biological brain from human brain cells. Could be not only the same size as a human brain, but could potentially be bigger than a human brain in a robot body. So there, your eyebrows, I mean, if people could see now, your eyebrows are raised when I say that. So it raises ethical questions as to the
result. It sounds
like
we're going to get a super robot before we get a super human.
I want
the superhumans first.
Yeah, I think it's a parallel thing. Both of them are interesting. And from a scientific point of view, we have to be careful what we're doing. And that question, if we now had here the robot with a brain power more powerful than a human brain, would I be able to switch it off? Would it let me? Or would it want to switch me off? is the big question. So it's a Terminator scenario.
We're getting into iRobot territory.
Yeah,
well,
but for real.
Yeah.
This is science. I mean, this is just making it a little bit bigger, a little bit larger, a little bit, you know.
Which is why I suppose these fuddy-duddies that you talk about are so concerned about this line, because once you cross the line a little bit, the further you go, that the further away that line seems to be, and then you fully, properly crossed it.
Well, I maybe that. I think there are those that say, okay, this is science fiction, this is science, and the two should never meet. I don't believe. I've always been excited by some science fiction. Michael Crichton, I absolutely love the Terminal Man and things like that. Even things like Jurassic Park were fantastic. But Terminal Man, guy having electrodes in his brain, it gives you ideas as a scientist. And as a scientist, we are really a mini science fiction person anyway. You come up with a hypothesis. I believe this is possible. And then you try and prove the hypothesis. That's what science is all about. And if you prove it, great. And so maybe a science fiction writer is looking perhaps 20, 30 years out, and you as a scientist are looking 2, 3, 5 years out. But you get overlap. Some science fiction writers are only looking 3 or 4 years out, and some scientists perhaps looking 10 years out. So you know, where is the boundary? There isn't. But for some people, I don't think they like to think of science fiction as being something that scientists are excited by, or moving towards or anything like that.
When's Cyborg 3.0 going to happen? When's your next implant, and what sort of capabilities do you think it'll give you?
Okay, well, I think there will be a Cyborg 2.5 first, because the magnet implants, it's something that was in the realms of body modification, artists more. It's now being scientific. We're looking at it scientifically, and it's tremendously exciting, the potential results. So I fancy having a go. The students are having tremendous fun with it, and I'm enormously jealous of what the students are doing. So I'd like to do that. 3.0, which is a brain implant, so it's serious stuff. And linking my brain to the computer and the internet and so on. I've said I'm not doing it before I'm 60 because it is dangerous. But I'm now 57, so, 4, 5 years, we're getting there.
And what about your wife, who's sitting here patiently listening to this interview? How does she feel? Actually, I'm going to
go ask her.
Yeah. Irina, how do you feel about the idea that in 3 years' time, Kevin might be getting a brain implant?
I'm scared of it. I don't want him to do it. I'm not going to do it myself. I said, no, it's too dangerous.
But you did take part in one of these experiments before. You think this is just one step too far?
Yeah, I feel it is too far at the moment. Maybe when the technology is a little bit improved, but still something to do with brain. He can be vegetable, and
you say that and kind of half smiling, but she's right in a way, Kevin. I mean, that's a real ethical question.
Yeah, but she knows that I am going to do it, so I think it's good for her worries. I mean, in a way, I share the worries, and with the surgeons, we will be looking to limit considerably the risks that are involved. But both from the point of view of helping enormous numbers of people. And the possibilities for enhancement, it's something that I, as a scientist, I want to do. And I'm sure if it fails, people will say, what a silly idiot, he should have looked at the risks. And if it succeeds, there'll be even more critics than there have been before. So I expect that to happen, and hence don't worry about it at all.
It's been fascinating speaking to Professor Kevin Warwick from the University of Reading. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you. Enjoyed it.
You know, I was honestly a little bit uncomfortable for the last part of that interview because I was watching Kevin discuss this brain implant while Irina looked on, and the look on her face, it was one of serious concern that, as she said, Kevin may end up becoming a vegetable after it. I suppose we'll only have to wait and see. In a few years' time, Kevin Warwick will get that operation and we'll know what happens with it. But it was a little bit awkward in the room. Anyway, still to come, Niamh Shaw on boosting your creativity and why human beings see in colour. You're very welcome back to Future Proof on News Talk 106 to 108 FM. I keep going on about it, but we do love people following us on Twitter. At News Talk Science is our address. Do follow us. We do try and keep you up to date with the latest science news, as well as letting you know what's going on with the show. Still to come, as we said, we're going to be speaking to Mark Changizi about why we see in colour and why human beings have two eyes facing forward. But joining us in studio now is Niamh Shaw. Welcome back to the studio, Niamh. How
Thank
are you?
Thank you, Jonathan. I'm very good. Very good.
Niamh is our experimental part yes. of the show. We get Niamh to try out stuff for yes. or scientific theories and see mm-hmm. whether or not they work in a practical sort
yes.
of way.
Yes.
So we asked you to test your creativity or yeah. boost mm. your creativity this week. Mm. What exactly were you looking at?
I was looking at, it came from an idea of an article that was in this month's Scientific American, where they, this kind of new research which explains why a lot of creative people are quite eccentric. And they've linked the thought patterns of creative people to schizotypal personality. And that's the kind of people that believe in sort of magical thinking. They believe that, you know, paranormal activity, telepathy, they would tend to kind of prefer to work on their own rather than go out socializing. And they found that there is a thought process going on in creative people's minds called cognitive disinhibition. And what that does is normal people will filter out a lot of stuff that they don't need. If it doesn't meet their current goals or for survival, they'll push it away. Creative people and schizotypal people have a tendency to not have that filter working. And so they're taking in loads and loads and loads of information and keeping it at the back of their heads, which is why they can make all these amazing connections and why they get ideas that come out of nowhere and they have those aha brainwave moments.
Oh. So
that's why they're explaining this. People like Einstein, that's why he was such a genius and why he was slightly eccentric as well.
I see. So because you...
because of the way of filtering information and the way they do that means that they actually are taking in more information around them and they're forming links and associations subliminally without even realising it. And that's where the art comes from, or the creative process comes from.
Because it's a very fine line between eccentricity and genius.
Well, that's what they were saying. What makes the difference is for it not to turn into some sort of a disorder, it's having the control and the IQ to be able to take that information, assess it and be able to basically create something from it.
Right.
So they reckon that highly creative people they might be slightly eccentric, but they also have a very high IQ, and then their creativity levels would be off the scale as well.
Right. So for those of us who aren't eccentric, is there a way for us to be more creative? And so you were looking at ways that one of these Harvard doctors had come up
yes.
with in order to make yourself more creative.
Yes, there's sort of seven forms of thinking that you can do on a daily basis to boost your creativity, because a lot of companies now are recruiting people who are creative because they need this in innovative technology. So they broke it down to seven different types of exercises. And the first one is absorb brain set. And that's where you're trying to get your brain to absorb as much information as you can. So when you're looking at something, you focus for a long period of time on something and take all the information in. The second one is the connect brain set, which is being able to think outside the box. So it's about making connections. That's quite a logical one. So there's exercises for that, giving you kind of logical exercises. There's a reason brain set, which is where you're trying to train your brain to stop thinking negative thoughts. A lot of neuro-linguistic programming techniques would use that brain set, you know, NLP, positive affirmations and all that. Then there's the visualize brain set, where you're thinking visually all the time. And that's what really boosts creativity. So you're thinking of, like, you could, what their exercise was is look at a newspaper and read the article and go, what if scenario? So try and think of alternative endings or alternative beginnings, or what if this happened or what if that happened, to open up your brain. There's the transform brain set, which is about using anything emotional or that made you vulnerable in a positive way. So analysing yourself and trying to find a way of writing about it,
right.
Because a lot of art forms would come from a lot of pain, you know, a lot of really good art.
Some of the best albums
comes from breakups and
yeah,
stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
Like,
almost, I mean, I think almost the best songs are songs about loss or songs about, you know.
We look at Amy Winehouse's album. I mean, that just took off, and that was just one album she wrote in a splurge over breaking up.
Nirvana,
Rodin, sculptures and everything. A lot of them is to do with pain and obsessional love and all sorts of terrible tormenting things. Then there's the stream brain set, which is the flow. This is where you want to be when you're an artist, is that thing that you're completely absorbed in what you're doing. You don't need any outside distractions, and that's where really amazing things happen. And the final one is the evaluate brain set, where you get to sort of filter everything down. So there was a series of exercises which I did.
Okay, if you wanted to have a look at these. And if you need to be creative for something coming up, if there's a big task in work, or if you want to break some barriers in creativity, mm-hmm. you'll find this list up on our website and yeah. how to do these exercises on newstalk.ie/futureproof. So what we did is we got you to do a haiku before
yes.
doing all these mindsets.
Yes.
And then a haiku after.
Yes.
And we're going to judge you now on your haikus.
Well, but they won't be good anyway because I'm not a good poet.
Okay, so do okay. them in whichever order you,
order
want,
you want.
And I'll see. And I'll tell you which one I think is better.
Okay. Okay, this is one. Sun beams on my face. Smile gently forms through squinted eyes. Happy summertime. That's one.
Okay.
Okay. Second one then is April sun shining. Summer is upon us soon. Skimpy clothes to come. It's the creative.
See, how do you? I mean, this is my problem with it. How do you judge creativity? How do I know if one is
Does
more?
Does it make
creative
a better connection for you? Did you get a stronger?
I prefer
sense?
The first one.
Very good. That was the one I wrote after I did all the exercises. Cha-ching!
That's what you call right there. That is a trial of science.
Total. Total trial. And that's not, that wasn't fixed. Honest to goodness. It did actually help though. Seriously, it did. Because haiku, you know, is a structure.
Japanese
you have to go
poem.
With 5 syllables, 7 syllables, 5 syllable, you know, lines. And yeah, it was definitely easier the second time I did it. Definitely easier.
Right.
God, I could be onto something.
I don't feel entirely satisfied by what we did here though, but I think we need to get you out and in dangerous situations again. So next week I think we'll get you to do something a little bit more physical. Although this was very interesting and enlightening.
Yes, it was.
If you want to boost your creativity, you can find out more on our website. Niamh Shaw, thanks very much for coming in.
Okay, Jonathan.
Now, if you enjoyed our piece a few weeks ago on the science of sound, then you'll notice a theme developing on the programme. This week, we take a look at the science of sight. Joining us now is Mark Changizi. He's author of The Vision Revolution and director of human cognition at 2AI Labs. Hi, Mark. How are you?
Oh, great to be here.
Your area of expertise, Mark, is evolution and how we have evolved to perceive things the way we do. So let's start off with a comparison. How do we see things differently from cows and dogs and birds, for example?
Well, yeah, so in the case of birds, well, actually, let's start with dogs and cows. We say that we have color vision and they don't. It's not, a little bit more carefully, they have grayscale and then they have blue-yellow. Blue and yellow are opposites. And so anything that you can build from black and whites and blues and yellows, your dog can see. That's a two-dimensional space of color. What we primates have is another dimension, a red-green dimension of color that they don't have. Now, it turns out birds have yet another dimension beyond ours. So what, you know, in fact, it's not just birds, but vertebrates generally, besides the mammals, have 4 dimensions of color. And the mammals, during the times that we were small rat-like creatures, is the story, you know, hiding in the, and you know, being nocturnal when there were dinosaurs around still, we lost our color vision. We just became just 2 dimensions of color. We lost 2 whole dimensions of color compared to what birds still retain today. And then later, some of us primates got 1 of those dimensions back. And so my research really is on what was that new dimension of color that we primates got back. What was it for?
Right. Well, why do we see more colors than cows and dogs then? Why do we see reds and greens?
So the argument that historically people thought it was about primates finding fruit in the forest or finding leaves. And one of the problems with that kind of idea for 100 years was that there's lots of different primates with lots of different varieties of diets and tremendous variation in the kinds of colors that you find for fruit. And yet we all have, we primates, especially us old world primates, both the apes and the other macaque-like kinds of monkeys that most people have heard of, have the same kind of color vision. So why would it be that this same, in a particularly peculiar kind of color vision that I mentioned, would be good for this radical diversity of food? So it struck me, for within your own ethnicity, people tend to judge the color of their own skin and those people that they're around the most as having uncolory skin. And other people, that other ethnicity over there, they have a colory skin. Same for accent. You have an accent to me, but to me, I don't have an accent. And of course, you think I have the accent. And the reason we're like that is because you need to be, if you want to be hypersensitive to the little emotional variations that happen in the accents of those around you, then it should feel like nothing to hear the accent that's the baseline accent around you. That way, every little blip away from that, you hear it, you feel it. And the same thing happens for the color of skin. The reason that skin color of your own ethnicity or what you're most commonly experienced with looks on color is because you want to be sensitive to the little color variations deviating from that, so that you can predict the behaviors of those around you. So these are the blushes, the blanches, the getting red when you're angry. And our faces show all these things, which people have long, of course, known. But the trick here was, I said, well, could it be that the weird, peculiar color vision that we have, where our two cones are almost in the same spot, could this, in fact, be a good idea when you're trying to sense those particular kinds of emotional signals? And it turns out when you work out just what is, you know, it's hemoglobin and how it oxygenates and deoxygenates, and that's what determines how the spectrum of your skin changes. And when you work out how what your cones would have to be like to be sensitive to that, it turns out you'd have to have cones just like our peculiar cone system for our primates. You need our kind of three color or our kind of color vision in order to be optimally sensitive to sensing the moods and the emotions and the health on the faces and the bare rumps and bare skins of other primates.
So you're saying the reason we've evolved this ability to see in color is because of the lack of color of our skin?
Yeah, that's right. The lack of color of our skin is really all about looking uncolory so that you can deviate away from that and suddenly signal with very small spectral so that you can see the very slight spectral modulation. This is the same reason your own saliva tastes like nothing. It's so that the small deviation, anything that you put in your mouth, you can minutely taste.
I have to say, Mark, when I read that, I thought, this guy's absolutely crazy. He's saying this amazing world of color that we have evolved from a need to detect slight changes in the color of our skin. And then I read that bit that you wrote about the primates and how the primates that have color vision are also the ones that don't have fur on their faces, fur that would hide these changes in the color of our skin.
Right. And this is one of the problems with being human or being any kind of animal is that you, whatever is completely normal for you and your species, you don't even notice it as a phenomenon that needs to be explained. For the most part, we don't look at our faces and think, how weird is it that our faces are bare? Because it's just what it is to see every day and look at yourself in the mirror and look at everybody else. But of course, this is a very strange thing across mammals. Most mammals are furry-faced, furry-rumped, and so and it turned out that one of the predictions of my hypothesis was, well, it better be the case that all the color vision primates should be the ones that have bare faces, bare rumps, and other bare spots that are color signaling, and the primates that don't have color vision should be either have your typical furry faces, and that's what I found.
There is something else as well, isn't there, that separates us from the animal kingdom, that not just color vision, but also the fact that we see with two eyes facing forward, which is, apart from the primates, quite rare in the animal kingdom.
So yeah, the main design across the earth, if you had to sum it up in a sentence, would be have eyes on the sides of your head. Nearly all fish are like this. Most vertebrate, most reptiles are like this. Most birds are like this, and even a large share of mammals are like this. And the reason that it's a good idea is because you've got two eyes. And you want to maximize how much you can see around you with those two eyes. So put one on the left, you get to see the left hemisphere. One on the right, you get to see the right hemisphere. That gives you the whole hemisphere. Now, historically, arguments for why some of us mammals have these forward-facing eyes are much more variation. There's all levels from forward-facing to sideways-facing amongst the mammals. There's sort of the whole range. And so what explains that variability? Historically, there's many hypotheses. Most of them are floating in some way around 3D perception, the special 3D perception that we get when we look at those magic eye books and it pops out. You see that in all the 3D movies are based upon. And the problem with that hypothesis, there's many problems with that hypothesis. One is that all these other animals that I already mentioned that have sideways-facing eyes, they have very thin binocular fields where they do get 3D vision inside there. But the question is, why should you want to have a big field out front of 3D when you thereby don't get to see anything at all behind you? So one of the biggest theoretical problems of the old ideas was, why should an animal be willing to be blind behind? That's an infinite loss of information in some sense. Why is it worth having a little bit better 3D vision up front for that cost behind? And the answer in my hypothesis was that... Yeah.
I thought you were looking for me for an answer, and I haven't a clue.
Well, I was hoping you had something. So the idea was that when you're in the forest, things change. When you're in leafy environments, the math changes. So when you're out, of the leafy environments, then you should definitely have eyes on the side of your head. That's that you can see the most when you have that. If you're in forest or in leafy environments, then when you're small, it turns out to still be the best solution to see the most in your environment to have eyes on the side. So let me give you, try to get across the impression about the advantage that you get when you're big and in the forest. So if you, and everybody's noticed this when they're a kid, if you hold up your finger out in front of you vertically and you look at something far beyond your finger, you'll see two copies of your finger, and they'll be rendered as semi-transparent. You'll see two copies of your finger, but each will be transparent through which you see the world beyond. In fact, if you lift all of your fingers vertically in your visual field, you'll see all of them as semi-transparent, and you won't really miss a thing beyond your fingers. What your brain is in this case doing is your left eye is getting one view beyond the fingers, and your right eye is getting an utterly different view beyond your fingers. In fact, they may not overlap at all. That is, your two views from your two eyes, looking through the slats of the fence or the slats between your fingers, may be entirely different puzzle pieces of the world. And what your brain is really good at, and there's all these studies that have shown that they have mechanisms that are good at fusing these two distinct, you know, stripes of the world. What this goes to show is that what the brain, or what binocular vision is all about, is the claim here, is that it's not about the standard view is that you get two eyes on different places on your head, and they see the same stuff from two different views, two different positions, and then they can work out the 3D depth. Here it's completely different. The idea is that eyes in different positions on your head can look through stuff out past clutter out in the world and see different stuff. You don't even get the same view of the. You don't get two different views of the same stuff. You just get two different views, and you can fuse it. You can make a single image out of that. And what that allows you when you're in a big creature like an ape in a forest with lots of leaves is that the math changes, and suddenly you can see better beyond the layer of clutters out in front of you.
Yeah, I guess that sort of makes sense to me. If you want to know more, you can buy the book. It's called The Vision Revolution. Mark Changizi, thank you very much for coming on the program.
Thank you.
I'd love to know what you made of that. Were you convinced by the arguments of Mark Changizi? As I say, he goes into much more detail in the book, and it's actually pretty convincing, some of the ideas, even though they're quite way out there. You can find a link to it up on our website, newstalk.ie/futureproof. Well, I hope you enjoyed this week's programme. As I say, if you missed any of it, you can log on to the website for the podcast from Sunday morning onwards. My thanks to Sean O'Boyle, producer, and researchers Cormac McAdam and Diane McSweeney. On next week's Future Proof, the FBI's Guide to Reading Body Language. That's next Saturday at 6 p.m. on News Talk 106 to 108.
Future Proof, in partnership with Science Foundation Ireland. Research for Ireland's future on News Talk 106 to 108.
Thanks for listening to this News Talk 106 to 108 podcast. To download other programmes or for more information, go to newstalk.ie.